And yeah, it was chaos. You know, I had no salary. I invested my entire life savings. Yes, we moved into student accommodation, one bedroom flat, you know, 90 minutes outside of London, commuting in every morning at 7 a.m., going back by 9 p.m., I mean, hugely draining. But you gotta make it work somehow.
Today's guest has not only built a hyper-successful business, he created a brand new industry. In 2012, Timo Bolt thought to himself, wouldn't it be great if all the ingredients I need to prepare a healthy, delicious meal are delivered to my door in the exact right quantities? Turns out that hundreds of thousands of people thought that was a fantastic idea too, and Gusto is now worth nearly $2 billion and delivers 250,000 kits each month. I'm your host, Bex Burn-Callender, and I'm going to quiz Timo on how he did it, and crucially how he used artificial intelligence, machine learning, and epic quantities of data to create this modern, sustainable, fast growth brand, and how you can use the same principles in your business. Hiya, Timo, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bex. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. So for the uninitiated, what is Gusto? So what do people get in these kits? Tell me a bit about the product you've created.
Sure. So you go in your app, on your website, on your mobile phone, you browse 100 recipes. You choose whatever you and your family love to cook, healthy recipes, quick recipes, you know, fitness related recipes. There's so much choice on the venue, vegan, pescatarian, anything. And we deliver all the ingredients and exact portions to your door. And so you still cook, but we make your life a lot easier, healthier, more convenient. And you can focus on what's fun, the togetherness, the eating. It's fresh from the farm, so high quality produce. And, you know, 87% of people in this country cook almost every single day. And so 1 billion meals are eaten every single week. Lunch, dinner times 67 million people, very basic math. And our share of stomach today is 2%, 3%. And so we are still on day zero or day one. This is the very beginning of a long journey.
I love that, the share of stomach. I hadn't heard that before, but I suppose it's true. You're kind of vying with the supermarket shop and, I don't know, delivery services for like takeaways and the home cooked meal. But what's been driving take up? So what is it that people are looking for when they sign up for Gusto? Is it all about convenience? I see that you're like take sustainability very seriously. Is that another reason why people sign up? Tell me, what are the catalysts?
Yeah, so look, I founded Gusto in 2012 with a vision of being the most loved way to eat dinner. And so big focus on love, on customers, very, very customer-centric company, very product-led. And the purpose has always been, for now 11 years, has been to build products that have positive impact on people and the planet. And so today, 23% of CO2 emissions are taken out every single time you eat dinner through Gusto versus the equivalent supermarket shop. We're pushing the boundaries. We're getting plastic to 100% recyclable now, food waste to, you know, 0.something% versus 20% in the traditional supermarket supply chain. And so, yes, kind of purpose and sustainability and health have always been parts of the journey. And the big three trends we've seen in 2012 and I see today have been and are sustainability, health, and convenience. That's kind of what's driving the change in the market. And then what we do is enabled by technology.
And in fact, you've been quoted as saying that Gusto is a data company that happens to love food. Can you tell me more about that? So how have you created the mechanisms to harness the kinds of data that let you make really impactful decisions within the business?
We've been lucky that since day one, we had amazing people. And, you know, employee number 8 was a machine learning PhD. And so he early on kind of told us about the power of AI and data. I had no clue back then. I don't have a tech background, so I had to learn kind of on the job, and it's been massively fun. But so early on, kind of we tried to build data into everything we do from a decision point, from a feedback loop perspective. And early on, we realized if we can make customer satisfaction amazingly high, we create this virtuous circle of great product, you know, customers being super happy, referring more friends, being more loyal, buying more, and us therefore investing more and more into product experience. And to create such virtuous circle, you need a lot of data points to understand, you know, is it the delivery, the price point, the quality of the food, the cooking time, the choice? There's so many components in this business model that you have to master. And the only way to ever do that is through data and really understanding kind of what customers tell you.
And how do you get that data? So are you kind of, are you asking customers what they like best? Or is there a way of getting this data without having customers sort of go through a review process or a feedback process? Like, how can you know why they're buying the meal?
So one of the early insights was, you know, in 2012, we asked people, what do you want to eat? And just like myself, everyone said healthy salads, you know, high protein, low carb stuff. And then we actually looked at what people are choosing. And they, you know, just like myself, they were choosing burgers and sausages and, you know, Italian pasta. And so early on, we had this belief that, yes, you have to ask customers what they want, but equally, it's really, really important to infer from their behavior what they actually buy every single week. And so today, Gusto has developed, I think, 6,000 recipes. And every week, a piece of AI, effectively the personalization engine, is choosing which ones out of these 6,000 recipes go into the 100 slots you see on the menu. And that changes on a weekly basis and takes into account seasonality, weather patterns, obviously cost, how many ingredients per meal, and so on, to optimize the experience at a user by user level.
And this sounds incredibly complicated in terms of, like, have you built this system, this AI, in-house, or did you buy a system off the shelf and modify it? Like, how did you access that level of, like, granular personalization?
So we build it from scratch because there's nothing out there that kind of was available off shelf. Otherwise, we would have tested it. And so, you know, we build it slowly, and over time we kind of added more and more and more data into the engine. You know, on day one, maybe we had how people rated the recipes, how many fish and veggie recipes we wanted. So very basic kind of design principles of what makes a great menu. Today, this is like way more complex. 200 plus factors are taken into account. Availability in the supply chain. What does Farmer Joe say about the rain forecast? And so on. And so it's become quite complicated over time. What we actually do today is we license that software to other businesses. And so we have a business that's called Bento, that takes the Gusto technology and offers individual items of technology to companies in totally different sectors. We have an Australian company that does gin and whiskey subscriptions. You know, we have female razor blade subscription businesses in the UK. And so it's a very diverse set of companies that actually uses these pieces of technology Gusto has.
And I'd love to hear more about how AI has helped you be a greener company, because the downside of convenience historically has been that it comes with an environmental cost. Like, often there's a lot of packaging, ingredients go from pillar to post before they reach you, they get processed a lot, but you're managing to strip out all of that, kind of all those carbon emissions and all that extra process. So tell me how you did that, and also how AI is helping you to make continuous improvements in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the saddest things in the world when you look at food waste and how food waste is contributing to CO2 emissions, whereas the reality is often there's win-win. If you take out some packaging, it's great for cost and it's even greater for the environment. And so we started early on to realize that there are tons of win-win situations. We then became a lot better in applying technology. So forecasting is a huge domain or area of focus for us. The better your forecasting, obviously the lower your food waste, and the better the shelf life for the customer. And so we use AI in forecasting, the personalization engine I mentioned, what goes onto the menu, how you run your supply chain. Do you put tomatoes on one station in the factory, 100 stations? the first station, the last station of how the box travels through the factory. I mean, no human has any clue how to ever solve that optimization challenge. And so we build a lot of kind of fulfillment AI, automatic order allocation, where to allocate the order, which factory, which shift, and so on. And so over time, we built a lot of technology that overall means that every single time we update the algorithms, our CO2 emissions go down. And that's really, really fun. And to bring this alive, you know, when we challenge the data science team to make the menu 10% greener, but don't tell the customer, make sure that the customer love, the satisfaction level is higher or the same, but it cannot be lower. They tried to figure out how to do that. Again, no human was able to. And then when we unleashed data science and AI, suddenly we were able to take 10%, another 10% of CO2 emissions out of the menu from an impact perspective, and customers didn't notice. You still have amazing choice on the menu. Your satisfaction is even higher. And so technology can play a massive, massive role in CO2 emission reduction.
But it sounds like madness because AI doesn't have taste buds, right? So how can it account for things like flavor? So you'd imagine that if you gave AI the task of making a recipe more efficient, they might strip out one expensive, unreliable ingredient like basil or something, but then it wouldn't taste so good. So how on earth do you teach this computer what tastes good and how you can't like tamper with that side of the meal? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, look, we have magician chefs and product designers that work tirelessly on making sure the meals are as amazing as possible. We have nutritionists working with them, photographers, food stylists, and so on. So it's a big, big, big team that makes it possible for customers. At the end of the day, what we see is data is augmenting these product people. And so if I'm a chef, you know, I might be crazy creative, but the algorithm can tell me what type of cuisine people are looking for, what they most like in February, March, summer. And so I effectively get kind of an insight from the AI, what people are searching for, what they want to eat based on season, weather forecast, everything. And then I get to be extremely creative. And so you still need the person being the magician. The AI cannot kind of design the recipe, but the AI kind of gets the most out of the person and kind of accelerates that process. And then secondly, look, we have amazing customers. We love our customers. Customers are putting in millions and millions of reviews every week. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Did you like that recipe? Was the cooking time accurate? And so on. So roughly 25% of recipes are rated every single week. And so you have this enormously rich kind of data flow telling you what customers love, when and why. And, you know, if customer Bex is from this and this segment, how does this segment behave? Are there people who look similarly to Bex? And therefore, we can make a recommendation to you as a customer based on people who look similarly. Or do we just look at Bex's previous behavior and therefore look at what looks most similar to what you previously ordered? So there are different types of algorithms. Very similar to what Netflix would use or Spotify would use.
Oh, that's really interesting. And your point about the relationship between people and technology is really fascinating, because we've been hearing for years that AI is coming, it's going to take your job, that's it, your career is over. But the way that you describe that interaction, like, no human being could possibly do the number crunching that this AI is doing. And so people are still contributing and their job is still as important, but it's just they get to focus on a certain kind of high value activity while the AI does the numbers. Is that true? Or is it that the future, you won't need the chefs, the AI will do the amazing magic making?
I think there will be more jobs for people than we have people. I mean, we have probably underpopulation as a big risk for human society in the next 100 years. But there will be tons of jobs, and these jobs will just be higher pay jobs and, you know, better focus and so on. And so I am hugely optimistic about AI and technology creating wealth for much bigger chunks of the population. I am fully kind of aware of the risks in AI and the bias issues. You know, who's training that data? Well, it's a bunch of people living in California. And so the recommendation is totally biased, right? It makes no sense to me if I locally search for something. And so there are tons of risks, and we need ethics and governance. But kind of the big point is AI will make everyone's life better. And most likely, you and I don't notice the day when AI really makes our life better. But over time, like we used an iPhone since, 2007, and it's kind of gotten better and better every single year. But neither you or me can say, oh, it was 2011, it was version 5 that kind of transformed everything. So it's kind of a gradual process of improvement, taking cost out, putting joy in, making things better, taking CO2 emissions out. And it's just amazing what opportunity lies ahead.
I like that. We'll just be working less and getting paid more. That sounds like a good outcome for everybody. And you mentioned right at the start of this chat that you're not from a tech background, and yet you seem so embracing of technology. And I know it must have helped that employee number 8 was this machine learning specialist, but for other founders, how do you recommend, like what ways can you offer that they can embrace technology as you have and be open to new ways of working that involve technology? Because it's not always that straightforward for people, is it?
Look, there's been a study done across 46 years that looked into why are some companies succeeding, whereas 90% of startups fail, or 90% of VC-backed startups fail, or whatever the statistic. It's a big US study. And the conclusion was that the number one differentiator is the ability to learn and kind of adapt and pivot when you need to pivot. And so to me, since we founded Gusto, one of the key kind of cultural pillars has always been growth mindset and how do you get everyone to learn and how do you create psychological safety so that people feel safe to admit errors. And instead of blaming people, we create this culture where people say like, oh, you know, I messed up XYZ. I reflected on it. And next time I'm committed to making XYZ change. And therefore, it's really beneficial to have errors in the system because nothing ever works perfectly. And so I think it's that learning mindset, beginner's mindset, starting from scratch, assuming that I know nothing every single day and I get to learn from you, Bex. I get to learn from every person I meet in the Gusto office, our customers, that I think creates this osmosis process that then leads to innovation. And so we hire people who love technology, who are really open-minded, who have growth mindset, and who don't feel threatened by technology every day.
No, that's really interesting and inspiring, because I was going to ask, back in the day, there were a lot of recipe box kits. It felt like there was a new one launching every 5 minutes. There was a point where I was getting like 15 press releases every week, and it was all like, there was one that was only keto and one that was only paleo. And I mean, it was ridiculous. But you've managed to outpace rivals and go the distance. And presumably this growth mindset is a piece of that puzzle. But what are the other reasons why you've managed to succeed where others have failed? Is it all down to this growth mindset and the tech, or is there other stuff at play?
That's very kind. Thank you. I think it's an industry where the barriers to entry are really low. You know, you could start a meal kit company tomorrow, and I'm sure you would have amazing recipe ideas. But the reality is that the barriers to scale are enormous, because we have built 100 million pound factories that are highly, highly automated. And so it's really hard to scale this model up to a decent size. And if you really want to give customers value, I think you have to have a very customer and product-led strategy. And I think a lot of companies that entered this market had a very marketing-led, discount-led, short-term optimization kind of led strategy. And so our philosophy always has been that if our product is better by an order of magnitude across what really matters to you as a customer, value, taste, choice, then we will grow and grow and grow. And so we try to keep us really honest. Are we getting better on quality? Yes, no. What are we doing about it? And can we make it 50% better and not 10% better? And so I think if you have that mindset where every single day you want to deliver customer value and you want to innovate the proposition, you know, why is the lead time 3 days? That makes no sense. Make it 1 day. Well, it's complicated to also have 0% food waste. And so you're going to innovate every single process and build capabilities to tackle these really, really big problems. And, you know, every day somebody in the team says, oh, this is so hard, we cannot do it. But the reality is we are doing it because it is so hard and it creates so much value to the customer. And if we can then pull it off and do the stuff that's hardest, it creates this moat around our business while delivering huge value to the customer. And so I think it's that mindset of customer first, huge value focus. Are we making this better? Yes, no, by an order of magnitude, every single quarter, year, week, whatever. Then I think we will go bigger, and double again in the short term. And it's really basic. Business sometimes overcomplicates, but it is only about the value you deliver to customers.
And when it comes to winning new customers, because you're right, there was this sort of race to the bottom with price. And I remember seeing all these offers, you know, first box free and second three boxes 50% off. And I just remember thinking, how on earth are you going to stay in business? You can't run a business like this. But it must have been that the cost of new customer acquisition was so high that it was almost worth losing money on that initial interaction. So how do you win new customers without massively denting your margin? Is it all referrals, or have you figured out a really clever way of getting people to try and to stay?
So half of new customers roughly are referrals. And so if I put £1 into product and the product becomes better and your happiness as a customer goes up, I effectively just refer more customers. And so product is my biggest marketing investment. And I'm putting huge, huge chunks of technology and product and data teams behind product instead of just marketing, if that makes sense. And so you have kind of more levers than just plain vanilla marketing. You have this massive kind of product growth engine. We do also do traditional marketing. I'm hugely proud of the team's work around the brand message, the cleverness of the brand, the storytelling behind it. And so we are big believers in brand marketing, above the line marketing, out of home, radio, podcasts, everything. But I do think the biggest channel by far is word of mouth. And it links back to the strategy that's so focused on product innovation.
That's such great advice. And it is just always the best recommendation because it's free and it's meaningful and it comes from someone you trust. So yeah, referrals are always the way to go if you can get them. Timo, I'd love for you to cast your mind back now, because I've read a little bit about the legend of how Gusto got started. And it just seems amazing to me that I think you were working at a hedge fund and then you had this idea and then you sort of jacked it all in. And then did you and your wife move into student halls while you did? Tell me about the
research,
sort of origin story. Yeah.
Yeah, look, I worked in investment banking. That was my first job. And then I moved into a hedge fund. And I'm quite geeky. I like numbers and data. But I never saw the purpose. I never saw kind of me doing this for 10 plus years. And I wanted to do something that has positive impact on people and the planet. And so I stepped out of the hedge fund in 2012 to found Gusto. And yeah, it was chaos. You know, I had no salary. I invested my entire life savings. Yes, we moved into a student accommodation, one bedroom flat, 90 minutes outside of London, commuting in every morning at 7 a.m., going back by 9 p.m. I mean, hugely draining. But you got to make it work somehow. And then every week on Wednesday, we would carve out the office. We would take the desks out and we would package in the office one day a week. And I would crash at a friend's place, at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. And then we would be back in the office again. And so just completely humble beginnings, chaotic beginnings. I hand delivered recipes myself. I designed recipes. I shot them on a basic iPhone. I did them in PowerPoint, the recipe card. But you got to do what you got to do. And it's enormously fun. And I miss these times. They're enormously fun when you go from zero to one and you have no idea if you ever find product market fit. You meet amazing people. You make friends for life. It's an adventure. But I am also glad this time is over. And, you know, it's been very chaotic. And now we have an amazing team. We have, 1,500, 2,000 people. And they are absolutely amazing. And so today has so many different benefits versus what we had in the early days. But yeah, it's been a long journey and it's been very fun. I'm very grateful to where I am. And it does come down to team.
And that's interesting about your background, because in the 15 or 20 years that I've been interviewing founders, I do see a lot of people with a background in investments. You know, they come out of these careers, they're unfulfilled in one way or another, but they do tend to build really robust businesses. So what would you say that you learned working either at the hedge fund or just in the investment space that stood you in good stead to create a really robust startup? What were the lessons that transferred really successfully from one realm to the other?
Oh, it's a great question. So Gusto's culture is really focused on dream, deliver, care. And I think the stuff that has prepared me the most is both on the dream side, like thinking really big and not kind of focusing in too much. And then on the deliver side, I think what I learned is I gained this little toolbox of analytical and commercial skills that allow me to focus on impact. If we have finite resource, do we do A or B? Because we can't do both. Otherwise, we're like out of money, we're bust. And so that focus on impact mindset and looking at the data and analyzing the data and making decisions in a, you know, back of the envelope way rather than building a huge spreadsheet is a really, really powerful skill set that I learned in the hedge fund and banking times. It's probably that skill set, focus on impact.
And I suppose also you have raised an awful lot of money in the history of Gusto. I mean, mind-boggling figures, and I'm going to ask you about that. But being quite rigorous in how that money is spent and being sure that you know how much capital is earmarked for which particular project, because you do see a lot of founders, you know, they get a huge injection of capital, VC capital, and it just kind of gets burned in a ridiculously short time with nothing to show for it. Whereas I suppose because you understand numbers, the value of money, maybe that could be a contributing factor.
Potentially. Look, I wish I had raised less money, but I'm very grateful to all the people that have supported us, and I love our shareholders. You know, we have thousands of people now supporting Gusto financially. I see this kind of as a core discipline. Where do you need to go 0 to 1? And by that, I mean, you know, what is product market fit? And do the unit economics really foreshadow financial success? And I couldn't care less about revenue in this stage. The only thing that matters to me is Bex as a customer, happy, yes, no. You know, and are we then kind of making money on that? And are we building a sustainable, financially sustainable business? Once you are in the 1 to 100 stage, the question is, how can we make Bex even happier? How can we make this more efficient? Can we do this in 2 months, not 4 months? And it becomes kind of an efficiency optimization equation. And you need very different mindsets across these different stages. And so if we launch new businesses, new revenue streams, we have this 0 to 1 mindset in these new areas. And then in Core Gusto, we have this 1 to 100 mindset where it is about rigor and discipline and, you know, protecting the customers and so on, and innovation at scale. And so I would say that intentionality about where you are and what success is vanity and what is sanity is extremely important. And I think in 2021, when capital was so cheap, you saw a lot of people getting carried away, conflating luck and success, and skipping that 0 to 1 phase and jumping straight into 0 to 100 and then running out of cash. To me, discipline and intentionality have been really useful.
I love that phrase. It's like, turnover is vanity, profit is sanity. I remember hearing that was always drilled into me when I used to interview business owners. But that point about investment, so you mentioned that the barrier to entry in a business like this is very low, but to achieve real scale takes money. So can you take me through the investment history? When did you first kind of realize that you needed to get kind of a big cash injection, and how did you decide how much? Just tell me a bit about kind of the capital journey of the business.
Yeah, so at a very high level, in 2012, I invested my life savings. And then I think by late 2012, a couple of friends and family invested, you know, a very modest amount. And then in 2013, so 1 year in, we appeared on Dragon's Den. And we didn't take the offer. We walked away, but we had a term sheet, which we presented to the Dragons. And we said, look, you have to match this valuation. You know, these are really credible kind of people from the food industry and they want to put 250K in. Can you match them? No. Okay, thank you. I mean, in a nutshell. And so we had these like angels that invested 250K and they really kicked us. Like, Timo, you are giving away free food. This is not a business. Like, this makes no sense. And they really, really challenged us to the core from, you know, a food safety perspective, from a hygiene perspective, from a sourcing perspective, going to the farm, smelling the tomato. Like, it was amazing as a catalyst. And then in 2014, so 2 years in, you know, we raised our first venture capital round. Quickly, we added two more venture capital firms. And they helped us mature the board, decision-making, take risk where we're supposed to take risk, de-risk where we're supposed to de-risk, and again, be intentional about where innovation is important and where you have to de-risk, you know, food standards and so on. And then over time, we've raised a lot of money, hundreds of millions, from much more kind of institutional capital, family offices, private equity, SoftBank, Fidelity, very late stage funds. I think the common denominator of all the people we have on the share register is that they passionately believe in the purpose. They passionately believe in the long term. We're not going to flip this. I'm not going to sell out in the next whatever. I want to, you know, run this for as long as possible. And that needs a certain mindset as a shareholder. You know, there is no IPO in whatever, 6 months and you get all your money back. No, we want to run this for the long run. And the only thing that matters is this good for the customer? And if an IPO or a fundraise is good for the customer, we'll do it. But it has to be good through that lens. And so we've been really fortunate. We have amazing shareholders, you know, MMC, Unilever Ventures, and so many of the early stage funds in the UK, BGF Ventures, Canaccord, Pervin. I can't name them all, but I mean, they have been amazing partners and I am very grateful. And from every single person that came into the Gusto journey, I learned one or three big things and they have shaped my thinking. And they have become partners and it's been fun. And you go through ups and downs. And only when you go through big downs, you realize, you know, who are the most amazing partners on this journey. And so far, I've had amazing partners and I am very lucky because, you know, it's not a straight line. You go up and down. But yeah, it's been a big learning curve.
And you said a moment ago that maybe you wish that you hadn't raised quite so much money because it is... It's a lot of pressure, isn't it? And it's a lot, especially when you've got so many shareholders. There's a lot of different, I suppose, demands, but also outcomes that these different shareholders are seeking. And they all have different appetite for growth and they all want to push in a different way. So if you had your time again, do you think that you would do more organic growth and maybe less sort of VC and kind of big investment rounds?
So it's a great question. 99 times I am the happiest person in the world and I'm extremely grateful to all our shareholders. And then there's one day where I think the grass is greener and I wish I had built a smaller business that had no shareholders and so on. And so I think the ratio 99-1 in favor of what we've done is pretty robust. And so I have absolutely no regrets. I think it made perfect sense. And there's this bifurcation point where you need to decide, like, what type of founder are you? What type of business do you want to build? And to me, what was clear is that if we want to have impact on the planet and all people, not just like, you know, a few hundred, we needed to raise a lot of capital. We needed to build infrastructure, factories. You know, my vision has always been to cater for the masses, not the classes. And to do that, you have to build infrastructure that brings down the price point. You have to leverage technology, hire hundreds of developers and AI engineers and so on to make it happen. And so no regrets. I love our shareholders. 99 times I'm happy. One time, you know, I do fantasize how would it look differently. But no, 99% of time it's awesome.
That's a cool mission for the masses, not the classes. So is that, would you like every single person, like every family to be able to afford to do things the Gusto way? And how achievable is that? And especially because we're living at a time when there are massive gaps in terms of like the nutrition and food education, and there's an obesity crisis, and there's cost of living pressures. So how many years will it take you to achieve that level of market penetration?
So I love the point you're making and the question. And every morning, all the stuff that you just mentioned pains me. I get up and it pains me. 57% of diet in this country is ultra processed food. And it's so bad for your lifespan, your health span, your mobility, every part of your life. And it's hugely sad for kids. I think it's 80% ultra processed. If you look at, you know, poorer demographics, it's so bad, the diet, and it literally cuts your lifespan by 5 to 10 years. And so I do see food as medicine, and I see this huge responsibility and opportunity for us to push into the space and make lives better. And so should the price point be lower or higher in the next 10 years? It should absolutely be lower. We work super, super, super hard to only pass on costs to the customer if we absolutely have to. And so if you look at the last 3 years of hyperinflation, 20%, you know, inflation in grocery, we've done the absolute minimum. And so our value for money has gotten up and up. That's a massive driver to me. But there are also other product parts. You know, can we one day give cancer patients meals that are fit for purpose and make their life or situation a tiny bit more beneficial? And so in the next couple of years, you can expect lots of collaboration with universities, with the NHS. We're going into testing mode. We're taking people's health and stress markers and biomarkers. We're putting them onto Gusto diet. We want to see what the impact is. We want to give people more of your five a day. And so there's a huge amount of opportunity. Also personalized nutrition. Since we built these hyper automated factories, can we push more into personalized nutrition? Gusto today offers 3 times more choice than the closest competition. And so huge, huge choice at a personalized level. But it is only day one. And so there's a lot of opportunity in the health space and really impacting people positively.
Wow. I had no idea there was that much going on behind the scenes. You just wouldn't think the potential that just putting together a kind of healthy, nutritious kit could have over the long term. It kind of boggles my mind a little bit.
Scary.
It's scary, but it's wonderful. And on the flip side, if we look at things like food security, you mentioned having this algorithm that looks at, for example, the impact of rainfall on the potential of a crop to even appear in the first place. And I'm talking to you from York, and Yorkshire's had insane flooding. We've got farmers around here who've literally seen their hard work kind of under 3 feet of water. So I'm interested to know how you work with the suppliers and across the supply chain to help them as well and ensure that they, you know, have a partner that supports them. So tell me about that side.
Yeah, so farming is really, really important because over the last 50 years, we have seen a lot of consolidation and kind of the big farms buying up everyone. And so working with independent farmers who deeply care about quality and have done this for 100 years is really important to what we do. And so one of the key initiatives for us is how do you give technology capabilities we build to farmers, to the supply chain? So forecasting, you know, a lot of the forecasting we see across farmers we work with is like the most basic forecasting. It's done in an Excel spreadsheet, if even, or on paper, and it's just not robust at all. And so if you can give these people some AI capability into forecasting, you literally save them so much waste and so much effort, and you make, you know, their livelihood a bit better. And so a big push is just how do we collaborate around technology? Another big area is how do you make the supply chain fit for purpose? So for example, for Gusto to decarbonize, we probably need to pay for some electric tractors in the supply chain and solar cells for the farmers who might not be able to afford them. And so increasingly, if we want to really take the CO2 emissions out, we depend on the farmers because 90% of our supply chain, 90% of CO2 emissions sit in our supply chain. And so a lot of kind of innovation and technology collaboration is happening.
And that's the point, isn't it? When you want to talk about being a sustainable brand, you can't just stop with your own activities. You've got to look at the impact of your organization across the whole supply chain, even to like what your customers do with your packaging. So on that point, sort of what's next for you on the sustainability journey? You mentioned helping farmers. How are you going to help your customers do even more to avert sort of greenhouse gases, carbon emissions?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are a couple of big points. One, there's the supply chain we talked about a bit. Then there's the packaging in itself. Every single item of packaging has to be compostable, reusable, recyclable. We're now at like 80%-ish. Why not 100? It needs to go to 100 as fast as possible. You know, why do I have to take the packaging away from the stock cube? Just chuck it in there and wait until it dissolves in water. And so there's so much innovation in the packaging field we need to tackle. Then I think it's the menu itself. I mean, stating the obvious, if you take beef off the menu, you have a greener menu. But we want to do it in a way that you as a customer feel like this is for me. This is amazing. I'm not compromising, because this is how you have mass market impact in terms of CO2 emissions. And so we'll work a lot with data science and the chefs and the product team on how do we make the menu greener, because that's where kind of the CO2 emissions are. And then work with the delivery companies to make all the cars green they use, help them with forecasting, help them with routing algorithms. And so a lot of work. And in the best possible way, we will not ask customers to help us. We'll do it for customers, because we really want to be that mass market proposition. And if you as a customer feel like you're paying for sustainability, it's easy to opt out. You know, in a cost of living crisis, we can't. I think it's too much to ask customers. The duty is upon us. It's our purpose. It's our mission we're on. And so the ball is in our corner to just make it greener and greener every year. We'll report every year. We report on our sustainability goals. We do it publicly. It's very transparent. And so that's where we want to push the boundaries.
It's so fascinating, isn't it, that food has become such a loaded concept. Like, it used to be food was about pleasure and about, you know, sustaining your own life. And now it's got all these kind of other stuff going. It's all these other considerations. You're talking about ultra processed food. We're worried about putting on weight. We're worried about the emissions that our food puts into the... It's really hard, isn't it? There's just so much to think about when you're just looking at a plate of food now.
Yeah, and it's a great point, and it's deeply personal. If you eat a lot of protein, you probably encourage muscle growth. If somebody who's got cancer eats a lot of protein, the cancer might grow. And so I think the clear insight is, and it's dawning up on us as population, is that food has to be personalized. And today you and I are ordering the same food and we're eating the same portion, but it actually doesn't make sense. It should be personalized. And so I think the next 10 years will be enormously fun and rewarding. Yes, it's loaded and a lot of information will come, but companies such as Gusto can really have profound impact on customers. And 10 years ago, we didn't really know how we can unlock that. And today we at least have kind of a hinge of how that could play out.
And then I just wanted to ask you, because Gusto's had this long life, it's been in business 12 years, and you mentioned earlier that it hasn't been a straight line up, you know, there have been ups and downs. So can you tell me about a massive high point, like something that really sticks in your mind as, wow, you're kind of standing on the summit, you know, at the top of the mountain, great moment. And then similarly, can you tell me about a real low point where you just thought, what have I done? Or this was a terrible mistake, or I'm going to lose it all. Can you tell me about those two polarizing moments?
I mean, the low point, you know, running out of cash in the early days, or beginning of COVID, when we didn't know whether we could operate factories safely. We were a critical part of feeding the vulnerable, the population in the UK, collaborating with the government. But you have to keep your people safe. And in March 2020, no one had a clue how to do that. And so that was one of the lowest points, where we had, you know, calls every single day, a couple of times to understand how to keep people safe while being there for customers when they need us the most. That was, on a personal level, very, very hard, because you have to ask people to get into dangerous kind of territory, put their lives at risk to a certain extent to keep on delivering. That was one of the hardest moments. I mean, look, in terms of the best moments, it's seeing the impact we have on customers. It's the smiles we get from customers, the positive reviews. People send us letters saying, look, my cancer has improved. I mean, there's no science that kind of creates a direct link, but people are so passionately about what Gusto does in their life. And I think that kind of puts a huge smile on our team's face. Hiring really special people, rewarding really special people. I work with people who joined Gusto as interns 11 years ago. They're now at, you know, VP level jobs. And that is kind of the biggest joy, seeing their potential being unlocked. The thing I'm most proud of is all people and culture, and seeing their potential being unlocked and seeing them do amazing stuff for customers and them growing and getting more and more and more income and more benefits. That's really special on a personal level.
Oh, I love that. And I think that's probably a great place for us to stop. Let's end on a high note, talking about the great outcomes from Gusto. Thank you so much, Timo, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Really fun conversation, Bex. Thank you.
Thank you to Timo, and thank you so much to you, our listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already so you don't miss our next great episode. And check out sage.com/podcast to find out more ways to harness the power of technology to propel your business into the future. See you soon for more sound advice.